Hey, podcast listeners, it's Chris popping in here to let you know you can now find Think on Instagram. That's where I'll be sharing book recommendations, favorite moments from recent shows, and occasional behind-the-scenes looks at how Think gets made. So while you're listening to today's podcast, I hope you'll give us a follow. Just search for K-E-R-A Think. Okay, now on to today's show. Here's a really chilling geography lesson. If you were to take a map of the places where Americans have been hit hardest by HIV historically, and then overlay a map of where COVID has taken the highest toll, the spots would overlap in a lot of U.S. communities. Not coincidentally, these maps would also resemble places where people are most often harmed by poverty and police violence. Combined into a single document, you'd have a pretty comprehensive map of inequality. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Stephen W. Thrasher is Daniel H. Renberg Chair at Northwestern University's Medill School, on the faculty at Northwestern's Institute of Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, and a columnist for Scientific American. He's actually done this map exercise, starting in St. Louis and New York, because those are cities he knows well. And he hopes that identifying the patterns among AIDS, COVID, and other stark disadvantages could also offer a roadmap to eliminating those life and death disparities. His book about this is called The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be with you.
You were living in Brooklyn in March of 2020, and your enduring sensory memory of that time is just siren after siren after siren.
It was. Those days, I would wake up to the sirens. You would hear them throughout the day. Sometimes you would hear, you'd realize you were hearing two overlapping, sometimes three overlapping. And I think that was a very fundamentally different way that people experienced the pandemic. It had to do with living in cities, but I also talked to people who lived in rural places, and if they lived near the hospital, they had a very acute sense of who was getting very sick, who was dying, that other people who didn't have that sensory experience might not have. And that's something that has stayed with me throughout these 2.5 years now, even as I've been in places where you hear the sirens and not, but that has really endured in my memory in a very sharp way.
I remember early on, lots of people tried to encourage compliance, right, with things like masking and social distancing recommendations by insisting that the virus doesn't discriminate. And maybe that's true for the virus, but humans do discriminate, and that's where the problems start.
Yeah, you know, this is something that we wrestle with a lot, and we're frankly, starting to wrestle with it in a very direct way with monkeypox and our latest epidemic happening right now. Right before we came on the air, I saw a New York Times news alert. I'm looking at it saying breaking news. The Biden administration plans to declare a public health emergency for monkeypox as soon as Thursday, signaling the outbreak poses a significant threat to Americans. And I'm very didactic about looking at language. And so I think this is, it's a curious phrasing to say that they're now saying it could pose a threat to Americans, because all of us who've been at risk for it the past few months are also Americans. And I think that that's, a way that we may say, society may say viruses do or don't discriminate, anyone can be affected. And in theory, you're right, from the virus's point of view, any person they can move into is fair game. But there are very specific reasons why certain bodies end up in the pathways of viruses, sometimes very, very different viruses, repeatedly over and over again. The kind of prophylaxis they have, you know, whether or not they are being protected pharmacologically with vaccines, with physical barriers, or whether or not they just get to avoid them in the first place, as many people who work from home did with COVID-19. And then all these reasons of inequality that have led the person to be in that pathway have a great deal of how sick they're going to get and whether or not they're going to live and die. And certainly COVID-19 is the most acute, concentrated, dense way that we've been able to see that, certainly in the past 110 years of United States American health, that you could really see certain people are coming into the pathway of it. And depending on their race, sexuality, national status, income, that's going to have a very big effect on whether or not they get seriously sick or die. And it's unsettling. I think this happened with COVID. I'm seeing it happen now with monkeypox. that when the idea that anyone could get a virus takes hold, then the society mobilizes more efficiently and quicker. But when it's people who are already living in the margins, who have already been removed from sight in the society, then the process happens much slower. And often the attitude from sort of the ruling class and government and business is that it's their fault for coming into the pathway of this virus, and it's not until it's perceived that anyone can be infected by it that they start to take it more seriously.
Just to make sure we're not leaving anything between the lines here, because monkeypox is still relatively new on the horizon for a lot of Americans, are you saying that we're taking it more seriously now that sort of anyone can get it than we were when health officials were most concerned about transmission among men who have sex with men?
Well, it's still primarily happening between men who have sex with men. And I am one myself. I'm a gay man. And I do think that the perception, and certainly see with media framing, the idea that it can happen to, you know, the quote unquote general population engages health officials in a different way. But we should consider gay people, gay men, you know, part of the general population of the United States. And, you know, there are quite different things between a virus, both biologically, you know, a virus like HIV, a virus like monkeypox, and a virus like SARS-CoV-2 that have different qualities. And monkeypox and HIV, you know, we think of them a lot as having a dimension of sexual transmission. Certainly HIV was primarily, we were aware of it in terms of sexual transmission, also injection drug use in the early years in the United States. But in many countries around the world, it moves more through parent to child, it moves to injection drug use. Even in some states in the United States, it's primarily injection drug use, but there's a sexual dimension to it. There's certainly a sexual dimension to the way that monkeypox is moving right now between men who have sex with men. And that is like that is a health emergency, whether or not, you know, even if it's only primarily affecting that community, and worldwide, the studies have been showing outside of the endemic countries in Africa, where it's been for decades, but in this outbreak, between 95 and 99%, it's been moving between men who have sex with men. And I think that is a public health emergency. Our health is important. It's important for us. It's important for our own well-being. And in terms of thinking about population, you know, even broader population transmission, it's important to treat it there. And so I'm very worried that a lot of the messaging that's been quite clear from a number of us, I published my first piece in more than 2 months ago now about monkeypox, saying the Biden administration needed to get in front of it before Gay Pride Month and use Gay Pride Month as an opportunity to inoculate people and get vaccinations out. And they really took a wait and see approach and let it circulate much more widely before they moved in quicker. And so we really see a dimension of this with COVID-19 as well, right? Like when the United States was seeing it happen in Wuhan, China, seeing it start to develop in Asia, the country had sort of an idea of, you know, this is happening somewhere else. Somewhere else these things occur. And then it started coming into what I call viral underclass in the United States. The first big outbreak was in the nursing home near Kirkland, Washington. And those people are already out of sight and out of mind. And there wasn't the emergency sense. And then when it became, because it's a respiratory virus that moves very casually, and an idea that this could hit all kinds of people and that it could affect workers and reduce productivity, it gets taken much more seriously. And you can see that quite clearly in the different ways the viruses are treated from a public health standpoint economically, right? Like with COVID, eventually there were lots of forms of unemployment. There were ways to keep people at home. But then when it was decided, you know, only 100, 200,000 people a year dying of it is acceptable, a lot of that economic care went away. And with monkeypox right now, people are being told to quarantine for a month, and there's no economic help for them. And nobody can survive without, you know, without a salary for a month. And so, yeah, I think if there's a perception that workers are going to be taken out of the workforce, the government intervenes more. When it's considered something that's just happening to poor people, Black people, queer people, then they engage less.
What do all three of these viruses have in common in terms of the ways certain people are scapegoated for aspects of their identities that they can't control?
Well, I think, you know, that was sort of the way I started to think of this viral underclass. And it's a term that an activist named Sean Strube originally used to talk about when HIV is criminalized and how you're put into an immutable characteristic of your identity. puts you in a different state of being categorized by the law. For me, I really started to understand it in seeing how these viruses have like very, very different properties. And when I was seeing these maps, it, like, in a way, it doesn't make sense. I get in a way, you know, I've studied HIV and AIDS for long enough to know that there's a really tight correlation between poverty and race. And so when I was seeing those maps, it was still an aha moment for me when I went to Ferguson for the first time. I previously reported in the St. Louis area on HIV, and I asked my HIV contacts what I should look for in Ferguson, and they said, you know, you're going to sort of see the same dynamics you see other places because Ferguson has this higher rate of HIV and AIDS. And so that was an aha moment, but it certainly tracks for me. What I wasn't expecting was in those early days of the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic to see the same maps emerging. The first 12 people who died of COVID in St. Louis were all Black. And in New York, where I was at the time, in Queens and Jackson Heights, and sort of the epicenter of the epicenter, the first person from my extended social circle who died of COVID was a trans immigrant HIV positive person who died of COVID-19. And a mutual friend of ours started saying, like, look at these maps, and we're seeing them. These are the maps where the jails are. These are the maps where the most people go to jail from these neighborhoods. Jails, of course, have turned out to be even more than other viruses, because COVID's respiratory, an enormous engine of transmission of this pandemic. And so these viruses can have like really, really different characteristics. And the thing that is tying them together is it's the same kind of bodies where they most often find a home. And sometimes, you know, that makes kind of sense in a way that seems very intuitive to us. You might think that people who are trans and are who need hormones, if they can get safe health care, they're going to get the hormones through their doctor. And if they can't get safe health care, which is happening all across the country, including, you know, in Texas, where you are, you know, trans people are going to get health care in ways that aren't safe, and they're going to get hormones from the contraband market. And that, of course, increases their risk of hepatitis, HIV, things of this nature. And, you know, we can sort of see that intuitively. We can understand how sex makes some people intuitively more open to pathogens. What's a little more hidden, and what I think connects all of these things, are the ways that economics is a determinant of who's going to get them and how they're going to move. So for example, you know, we might understand that gay men having sex can have a component with monkeypox or HIV. But LGBT people were also much more susceptible to COVID-19, both at the level of infection and also the level of death. And that actually has less to do with how much we are socializing. Everybody, you know, everybody socializes, everybody breathes and has sex. But in the pandemic, you know, many people pulled back from that. But gay people are already more likely to be poor in the United States. And this is a misperception in media. I think a lot of people think of gay people as like Will and Grace or something. But LGBT people in the United States are more likely to be poor, less likely to have salaried work, highly represented in retail sales and in retail work, less likely to have stable housing, and less likely to have health insurance. And so for all of those reasons, you know, we had a higher proportion of LGBT people working in real estate face-to-face, not able to work from home, not having insurance, being homeless or precariously housed in a way that's going to make them more at risk for a virus like COVID-19. So even though COVID-19 is moving into LGBT people, not around our identities directly of gender, sexuality, or gender identity, it's moving into us economically, because all of the homophobia and the transphobia puts us in a position where we are precarious in our economic lives, in our housing lives, and in our professional lives. And in that way, what these viruses have in common is that they seek almost like a flood going into the lowest level of area to flood a space. They're looking for the easiest cracks to get into, and that's how they do it.
How has reporting on irresponsible behavior in the age of COVID reminded you of stories from the early days of the AIDS pandemic?
In the United States, we have a particular proclivity about trying to personalize everything and place blame on individuals. And the process of viruses moving between us is a collective experience. It happens socially. The opposite of social is sort of saying something happens in one person. And so one of the moments, which I write about in the book, that made me think about a lot of hysteria in early AIDS days was when media was reporting about COVID parties. And there was a story in the AP, there was a story in ABC News about how college students were hosting COVID parties, and they were deliberately, somebody would come, they test positive for COVID, and then they would come to the party, and everybody would get as close to them as they could. And then, you know, and they put money into a pot, and, you know, then they would all test over the next days. And this is when, like, nobody could get a test either in the early days, you know, and that was what was driving the transmission. And it's a complete urban legend. It never happened. It's been widely debunked, although these news organizations have never taken off their sites. But it's kind of a distillation of the way that we often want to imagine sickness, and that it's irresponsible people doing something wrong, purposefully trying to harm themselves and purposely trying to harm other people. And while the story was going viral online, and there wasn't a rise in young people getting COVID, and it had nothing to do with college campuses. Colleges were, it was in the summer, and colleges had been completely, you know, emptied in the early lockdown days. The reason why there was a rise in young people was because young people are the most likely to work in retail. And so after having been home and sort of considered marginally essential jobs, then they started having to go to Nike stores and Apple stores and, you know, clothing stores and work in the face of the virus and be exposed to it. And so, of course, there was a corresponding rise in their rate of COVID. And people who are older were more likely to be still working from home, still are. And so theirs did not go up as sharply. And in the early days of the AIDS pandemic, there was similarly a lot of blame, saying this is just irresponsible people doing. In some ways, it was more acute because it was happening to people who had long been despised by society and who were considered not, not as sort of quote unquote worthy as workers were with COVID. It was happening to gay men, homosexuals, and also to people who were dealing with addiction and the use of injection drugs. And so it took a very long time for Ronald Reagan himself to say AIDS. It took a long time for a lot of the federal government to kick in. And certainly there was really bad media framing in those early years, as if gay people were doing something bad and harmful that was going to harm the rest of the United States, when in fact something bad and harmful was happening to them. And so I've seen a lot of echoes in that, in the way that media narratives will form around blame, will create individual scapegoats to kind of contain the anxieties that the whole society is feeling about the situation, and sort of say, let's blame these people, rather than realizing there are certain people who the virus is moving into, and they deserve our support and compassion for their own well-being, but also taking care of them is actually key to making sure the virus is minimally harmful to the wider society.
Of course, all along, there have been people fighting from within marginalized communities to protect themselves and others less fortunate. The activist Zach Kostopoulos pointed out to you that although we like to think, we meaning sort of the general society, that nobody dies of HIV anymore. Plenty of people are still dying. They're just the kinds of people that societies have decided are not worthy of equivalent protections.
That's correct. In the United States, we've had great decreases in death, but many people still die of HIV and AIDS. And it's been a little hard to get a handle on the data over the last couple of years because they've been warped by COVID. But the better part of 1 million people a year die of HIV and AIDS around the world. The last year we had sort of clear data on it. It was about 750,000 people. And there's no excuse that anyone should be dying of AIDS anymore. There's been really fantastic medication since 1996. And as I've heard activists say often, you know, the science won the day, the medicine won the day, but then capitalism trumped them, because these drugs are available. They work very well. They have a capacity to work almost like a vaccine, where when people are taking HIV medications, the virus is so suppressed in their body, it cannot transmit beyond them. So the more people in the community get on them, the HIV starts to circle out of it. But it took 7 years from the time they were invented in the United States until they started getting into countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And during that time, hundreds of thousands or millions of people died. More people have died of AIDS since these medicines have been invented than they did before they were invented. And so my research has kind of led me to look into and try to understand why is it that more people, not only did more people die of AIDS after the medications, but in the United States, the racial disparities grew worse. It's about a 3-to-1 racial disparity of Black people having AIDS proportionally to white people once AIDS starts to kind of come into consciousness in the early 1980s. It's about 6-to-1 by 1996 when the medicines come. And then, like 20 years later, it's 9-to-1. And actually, Black people in the United States in 2015, last year I had data on, had a higher rate of AIDS 20 years after this medication than white people ever did before there was any medication. And we see something kind of similar with COVID as well, that the sort of worst effects that COVID have had on white people actually don't affect mortality the ways that even COVID has affected white people. And so pharmacological interventions alone don't save the day. And we have to like look at how do we undo racism and homophobia and economics to get the most people healthy as we can.
Stephen, I would have expected, based on descriptions of the book, to find what I did here. Homophobia is a problem. Racism is a problem. Ableism, ageism. An issue you raise in this book that I hadn't expected is speciesism. How does our disregard for animals and the protection of their habitats create vulnerability, additional vulnerability among these marginalized human populations?
Well, thank you for asking me. It was honestly, I even have a hard time saying the word speciesism, which I had when I was recording the audiobook. It was perhaps the most fascinating part of the book for me to read about. And I had vague senses of some of this, but speciesism is the way that we human or human animals, as some people call them, take a view of ourselves that we are on the top and that we dominate all other animals. And most people have probably seen at some point in their education a hierarchy of animals, you know, where humans are at the top of it and single cell organisms are at the bottom of it. And there's another way we could think about this, right? We could think that we are in a cycle with other people, with other animals. We could see ourselves in a relationship. But the three pandemics I think about the most, I guess monkeypox is not yet technically a pandemic, but I imagine that designation will come soon. They're all zoonotic. They're all viruses that were with certain animals and they came into human beings. And also what a lot of people forget about is they can go back into other animals. So HIV is probably moved into human beings in the 1920s as colonizers were moving into deeper and deeper into jungles in Africa. And monkeys were killed as bushmeat. And it was probably through the cuts of doing that killing that the virus first came into human beings and took decades to get to a critical mass where we started seeing and understanding that there was something there. And that's a very, very similar way to how viruses of all kinds move inside of slaughterhouses, that the work is extremely dangerous. Human beings cut themselves and viruses move into them. And this is predicated on just the idea that humans are in the top of all other animals and we should be able to kill and move and displace as many of them as we want. But we do so at our peril. You know, we've seen it with HIV moving into human beings, with most likely SARS-CoV-2 probably came from bats, perhaps by way of the pangolin, and then into the Wuhan market, and then into human beings. And monkeypox as well doesn't come from monkeys. It was studied in a monkey many decades ago, but it comes from rodents and prairie dogs and gophers and things like that. And so we have to acknowledge that we have these relationships with other animals, and if we don't try to just dominate them, we could make our relationship to viruses better. Climate change is going to be a catastrophe for this kind of viral movement. There was a big study in the journal Nature a couple weeks ago about how climate change is already affecting the habitat of bats. And we don't want to, as kind of cool as bats are as a creature, we want to mitigate our actual contact with them because they've been living for tens of millions of years with certain pathogens that are just fine. They've adapted to have no harm from them, but the second we encounter them, there could be a real problem. And climate change is forcing more human beings and more other animals onto a smaller and smaller percent of the globe. And the more that we come into contact with them, the more likely these kind of viral spillovers are to happen. So even though I am guiltily not a vegetarian or a vegan, I do think that there is a real argument for the ways that the principles of veganism, the principles of vegetarianism, encourage having a different kind of relationship to animals that would make our relationship to viruses better. And it happens kind of at the level of the human and the animal, but it also has to do with labor conditions. It has to do with how terribly animals are treated in slaughterhouses, but also how terrible human beings are treated in slaughterhouses, and how easily we think we should be able to raise a family in one continent, kill an animal on another continent, and then serve it to eat on another continent. And that's increasing the likelihood of viral transmission and the likelihood of climate change and the ways those two things can make the other problem worse.
So in this country, you know, people had lots of criticism for the Trump administration in the early days of this, but the Biden administration has been running things for more than a year and a half. What specifically do you think the administration, what opportunities has the Biden administration missed to address some of these challenges?
Yeah, you know, they've had the vaccine since they came in, so they should not have had more people die on their watch than Trump did on his. You know, kind of just at a tactical level, they should be paying for people who don't have health insurance to get COVID tests and get COVID treatment. And they failed. You know, they have the presidency, they have narrow, but they still have majorities in both houses of Congress. And they failed to pass their last $15 billion bill in March to continue on that kind of care. So that's on them. They have no interest in universal health care, which of course would make things better. And they made an enormous mistake in Biden not hiring the 100,000 healthcare workers that he said he was going to hire, and building some kind of permanent or at least flex semi-permanent vaccine distribution system. To its credit, you know, the administration put a lot of resources into getting people vaccinated early on. And at one point, we were doing 4 million people a day, which is unheard of in the United States. But a lot of that was jerry-rigged. It was done with a lot of volunteers and a sense of desperation. And so the administration missed the opportunity to build something permanent where you had a place to go get a vaccine. And they could have said, you know, every 3 months, 6 months, whatever, you can go get a COVID booster. They could have put monkeypox vaccines through if they needed to. They could do annual flu shots through it. And they didn't do that. And in some ways, they've just continued on what the American project does, is enormous resources to war and war making and few resources to actual well-being. But Biden himself has made these moves seemingly personally from what he wants to show, and that he's a quote unquote law and order guy. He didn't hire the 100,000 healthcare workers. He wants to hire 100,000 new cops. And he was preparing to go on the road even though he was 79 and it has been going massless for a long time. And he wanted to go on the road to ask for $37 billion for more cops. And he was failed by COVID. And then he personally has failed too, as a 79-year-old, you know, to model wearing a mask. The administration fails to ask and fight for interventions from judges. So when one judge said the airlines could no longer have mask mandates, they didn't really appeal it. They have not issued an emergency stay on a judge overturning protections to LGBT people. And those protections to LGBT people affect our civil rights, but they also make us more likely to become infected by viruses. And the administration doesn't fight hard on that. So I wish they were doing more things like that. And instead, they're kind of saying, we need tens of billions for Ukraine. They passed the most expensive military budget in the history of the United States by $100 billion more than Trump. And that money is paying for resources that could be going to ventilating classrooms, to COVID-19, to having infrastructure to get shots out to people for monkeypox or COVID. And they are just putting most of their eggs in baskets of cops and war.
I mean, this question could take us into a whole other hour that we don't have, Stephen, but why do you think the United States, and not just lawmakers, but a lot of Americans have been broadly distrustful of the idea of a system that would offer universal access to healthcare despite our national wealth? What is the problem?
Well, I think first we have to admit that it's actually not a problem for the public. 70% of people have wanted something like Medicare for All since it's been polling over the past few years. Even a majority of Republicans want it. And so there's no issue with the American public. The American public wants this. And I don't think we should frame it as wishy-washy, you know, between those who do or don't. 70% is pretty good for any political consensus in the United States. Within the Democratic Party, they don't want it because they're funded by the healthcare lobby and they don't want it. In sort of a broader sense, Americans do have a narrative that we are all the captain of our own destiny and we shouldn't owe things to each other and we shouldn't expect things of one another. And so that is, you know, that's sort of a zeitgeist problem in some ways. But, you know, most people don't want to think that they can be ruined economically one day with a medical bill. And most people want to take care of one another. GoFundMe is the third biggest insurer by default in the United States by people giving money to one another to help each other. And they do it at, you know, great cost. And right now I'm seeing these GoFundMes for people who have monkeypox because they're having to quarantine for a month and they can't get any government help. So I think most people would want that. But the United States, certainly at the level of politicians and business, want to keep us all fighting for our own thing and try to scare everyone about what universal health care could look like. Even though we've had, like, the reason why we have 200 million plus people vaccinated is because, as every successful public health campaign around the world does, you know, we told people there will be no charge at point of service and the thing that you need, you can receive. I do think that one reason there's hesitancy around that, and I think a reason why there's hesitancy to universal health care, is that we've been told so long that you're on your own. And so anyone who's had the experience, as I have, you know, of like trying to pick out your doctor and your hospital for a procedure, and you go and have the procedure, and then you get an exorbitant bill saying you owe money because the anesthesiologist was not in your network, like, that makes you distrustful of systems. The way our systems are set up are not meant to be welcoming and are not meant to make people feel comfortable knowing that they're going to get care. They often think there's going to be an economic bomb behind it. And so that erodes the idea that there could be something like a social good that everybody participated in. But still lots of people, you know, they still want it. They do want to have something like Medicare for All so that they know they and their loved ones are not going to be ruined when something bad happens medically.
Would we need to somehow structure a program like that so that it's not perceived to benefit mostly members of the viral underclass? Is that the only way that sort of more privileged people would accept this?
I actually don't. I mean, there are people of goodwill that would disagree with me, and I understand the reasons why. I actually don't think we should shy away from these things because when we even though evidence shows, and Jonathan Metzl, who wrote the foreword to my book, he writes about in Dying of Whiteness, you know, when white people perceive that black people will benefit from Medicare for All, they don't want it and they reject it. And I think that there's no easy answer to this, but if white people or straight people or cis people are upset that black people, trans people, queer people are getting medical care, I think that we have to do the long-term difficult work of undoing that racism and homophobia and transphobia. I don't think the answer is to try to pretend like this isn't happening to people, because that creates shame and it makes it harder for the people who need help the most to not get it.
Stephen W. Thrasher is chair at Northwestern University's Medill School. He's a columnist for Scientific American and author of the book The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. Stephen, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast free where you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think or catch up on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.